triangular-shaped monument with a dome and two pyramid-shaped covers on top. It was built during the rule of the Qajar dynasty, at the beginning of the 18th Islamic century. Later, a veranda and some other monuments were added to it. The shrine of Imam Ali ibn Ja'far, after Astana Muqaddasa, transcends all other monuments and mausoleums of Qom province in terms of spectacular decorations. One of the most important features of this splendid shrine is its plasterwork, which is among the most outstanding artistic works of the 8th Islamic century. There are 94 pieces of gold inlaid tiles on the monument showing plant, animal, and human designs. Naskh inscriptions containing Quranic verses and religious stories and Persian literature are among other unique decorations of this shrine, while other inscriptions and decorations are common throughout Iran and in museums around the world. The gold inlaid altar of this monument, situated at the southern end of the shrine, was built in 734 AH. It is one of the greatest artistic works of its time. Today, this altar has pride of place at the Islamic Era Museum in Iran's National Museum. Jamkaran Mosque, where Shia Muslims believe that Muhammad al-Mahdi, the hidden 12th Imam, who will lead the world to an era of universal peace, once appeared and offered prayers. The mosque is located on the Qom-Kashan Road, 6 kilometers outside the city of Qom. According to Muhaddith Nuri, a contemporary religious scholar, the foundation of this mosque is credited to a man named Hassan ibn Muthleh Jamkarani, who was contracted to build the mosque upon the request of the 12th Imam. On Wednesday evenings, and especially on the 15th night of Sha'ban, Imam Zaman's birthday, Shia Muslims come here to pray. Imam Hassan Askari Mosque. Also located in Qom, near Ali Khani Bridge and next to Astana Street, is the monument of the 11th Shia Imam, Hassan Askari. It used to be called the Atiq Friday Prayer Mosque. According to various accounts, it was built by the Imam's representative, Ahmad ibn Ishaq Ash'ari, in the 3rd Islamic century. Since then, this monument has been renovated several times. Today, the oldest part of the monument is its southern veranda, built in 1750. The Imam Hassan Mosque has always been held in high esteem. Since the 9th Islamic century, the custodians of Astana Muqaddasa have been taking care of this mosque. Rebuilt in the final years of the Safavid period, today only the southern veranda remains standing. The monument sustained extensive damage during the Qajar era flooding. At the end of Qom's Chahar Mardan Street and inside a small garden called Bagh-e Gumbad-e Sabz, the Green Dome Garden, there are three historical monuments, relics from the 8th Islamic century. It is known as the Kashan Entrance. According to available historical documents, the two domes of this site are the tombs of the rulers of the Ali Safi House, independent sovereigns of Qom. The inscription on the third dome has been destroyed, so no one knows when it was made and who made it. But going by documents from various sources, this third dome, historically speaking, dates back to the same period and probably also belongs to one of the members of the Ali Safi house. The people of Qom call this collection of mausoleums Sa'd, Sa'id, and Mas'ud, the three senior Ash'ari Arabs that revitalized Qom during their time. The plaster work at these three monuments is one of a kind. 1. The tomb tower of Khaje Asiluddin, representing the tomb of two rulers of the Safi house in 761 AH. 2. The tomb tower of Khaje Ali Salih, representing the tomb of three rulers of the Safi house in 792 AH, and 3, the northern tomb tower belonging to the late 8th and early 9th Islamic centuries. The tombs at the Green Dome Garden were registered on the National Heritage List in 1931. The tomb towers located in the garden include a southern dome, a middle dome, and a northern dome. From among the valuable remembrances of Persian architecture are the old caravanserais, built in the past eras in a different communicative, economic, military, geographical, and religious environment, and then gradually over time developed and expanded. 2 kilometers from Mahmudabad village stands a clay castle on the edge of Gomrud. In the north of the village, there are 2 castles, one a famous stone castle and Islamic monument, and the other, called the clay castle, is made of mud. It is located north of Sefid Kul, White Mountain, in the lower northern region of Qom province. According to collected documents, this castle dates back to the Ashkani era and was inhabited in successive historical periods. The castle is 45 meters long and 29.5 meters wide, with walls of various heights but not higher than 10 meters. The castle may have served as a protective outpost monitoring travelers entering via Varamin and the fringe of Ray into the Qom district. It would have been portrayed as the landmark entrance to the city. Stone Caravanserai. This caravanserai is located on the Qom Road, 35 kilometers from Qom City. It is a 4-veranda caravanserai which lies in ruin and belongs to the Safavid period. The construction material used is mainly stone and has 4 semicircle-shaped towers on the western and eastern sides. Qom owes most of its global recognition to the holy shrine of Hazrat Ma'sumeh, which glitters like a diamond sitting in the middle of the city and every year attracts a large number of pilgrims. It is the smallest province of Iran, but is conveniently situated on the main interstate highway linking several major cities.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. in the limelight.
The Israeli regime will continue to shed Palestinian blood for fun or for political gain or to consolidate its occupation, says Refaat Al-Arir, writer, in an article published under the heading "Without Consequences, Israeli regime will continue to murder Palestinians." Stay tuned for more. Amal is now 2 years old. No one ever gets used to being bombarded every year or so. The kids in particular live in constant fear, but it does become part of life. As the Israeli missiles rained down on Gaza City recently, Amal, 6, asked her mom, memories of last year's horror still fresh. Will there be another war? During the assault, the children, especially Lina, 9, and Amal, have been mostly quiet. Amal has tried to sleep and Lina lay down in the living room. At night, like most kids in Gaza, they shriek in fear each time they hear an explosion. A report published by Euromed found that about 91% of Palestinian children live in constant trauma and terror due to recurrent Israeli regime attacks. Nothing can prepare you for this. The Zionist regime has been bombarding Gaza ever since the Second Intifada. They never get used to the bombs, and they never know how to deal with the sheer terror and absolute Israeli regime savagery. No lies or hugs or sweets can calm the kids down. When the bombs fall, the kids will always shirk in utter fear. The lies that things will be all right and that these are fireworks no longer work. The Zionist regime had killed at least 30 Palestinians, including 2 Islamic Jihad leaders and a little girl, Ala Qadum, recently. Well over 250 Palestinians have been injured and several homes and buildings have been destroyed or damaged. The Zionist regime's pretext this time is as flimsy as can be. After detaining a senior Islamic Jihad leader in the occupied West Bank, the Zionist regime said it was engaged in a preemptive operation to stop alleged missile attacks before they start. This is like the Zionist regime's war on Gaza in May 2021 and its massive 2014 attack and the many escalations between them. And it brings back memories of the Israeli regime's bombing campaigns in 2012, in 2008 to 2009, 2006, and many others, several of which coincided with Israeli regime elections. Many Palestinians have seen countless of their loved ones murdered in their sleep, or when they were resting and generally minding their own business. If the Zionist regime will kill Palestinians, regardless of who they are or what they are doing, then many Palestinians believe, why not die fighting and defending their country? There is no one more determined or dangerous than a person who has nothing to lose. During the May 2021 aggression, according to Air Wars, in more than 70% of Israeli regime attacks that killed Palestinian civilians, there was no reports of any casualties from the resistance. In other words, civilians were the only victims. According to B'Tselem, an Israeli rights group, nearly two-thirds of more than 2,200 Palestinians the Zionist regime killed in Gaza in 2014 were civilians. Notice that such statistics usually count Palestinian civilian police or resistance fighters killed in their homes as they slept as militants, as they claim. Given these realities, many children, women, and the elderly are not collateral damage, rather they are the Zionist regime's main targets. Indeed, we understand that when the Zionist regime escalates against Palestinians, its political leaders not only receive more votes in elections, they receive more support from Western countries. With the Zionist regime's polls projecting Benjamin Netanyahu to win a majority of more than 60 seats in upcoming elections, the current interim coalition regime, considered to be moderate by many liberals in the West, must have thought a quick war on Gaza might appeal to Israeli regime's electorate. Palestinians have become accustomed to the Zionist regime's carnage when elections approach. Israeli regime leaders know the best way to win votes is to flex their muscles. Their problem, in other words, is not with Netanyahu or the Likud, but with the Israeli regime occupation itself. Yet it is wrong to assume Israeli regime kills Palestinians only when there are elections on the horizon. Israeli and Zionist militias have been massacring Palestinians for approximately 100 years now. The fake regime of Israel is not satisfied with anything but total victory for its colonial rule. Palestinians are not Ukrainians for the world to care about. They are not mostly blonde with blue eyes. They are not Jews. And for being the wrong sort of people, it seems they have to starve, to live in fear and terror, and die without any lifting a finger. The sweets and the kids' favorite pudding remain untouched. Lina and Amal cower against the walls of the living room. They refuse to eat or be entertained. There will be more Israeli regime wars and more Israeli regime massacres. Will the Zionist regime war criminals ever pay for their crimes? Will Arab countries rushing to normalize ties with the fake regime of Israel see it for what it is? An entity built on the violent dispossession and dislocation of Palestinians? Can grassroots organizations and free people, wherever there may be, put more pressure on their governments to boycott and hold the fake regime of Israel accountable? If not, the lies, little and big, will continue. The fake regime of Israel will continue to shed Palestinian blood for fun or for political gain, or to consolidate its occupation, or simply because it can.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma, Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. how we are able to understand our daily routine as far as our relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and how we are able to not only attain sustenance and rizq, but also benefit on a spiritual, social, and moral level. The same way that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran mentions that He has divided the year into the Hijri year into 12 months, the same way as He has appointed certain times as holy, like Layal al-Qadr, for example, the same process of Almighty God allocating certain individuals and certain pieces of land on this earth as holy. We also understand that as far as our daily routine is concerned, it's important for us to find ways of improving the quality of that particular day. And there are many of these kind of ahadith that speak about, you know, how to stay away from nahs or sa'atu nahs and these kind of issues. Important thing is, here there is a necessity, an akhlaqi necessity in our adab in Islam for you to continue to pay sadaqah and do dua before you pay sadaqah, do dua after you pay sadaqah. Whatever you do, even when it comes to your whole, this whole process of working and wanting to do something for that day, you know, have some kind of policy. Let's say I work 20 days in a month. 3 of these days, the income for 3 of these days, I'm going to give as charity. I'm going to give to the masjid. I'm going to give for Imam Hussein. I'm going to have majalis of Imam Hussein. Whatever, like any kind of idea, I want to contribute to a sadaqah jariyah. You know, that means that you are working at really as a mujahid. As we said, al-mujahid, al-kad ala iyalihi, kal-mujahid fi sabilillah. But if you are wasting all of your energy only for dunyawi gains, for you to buy another house and a better car and another trip and another this and another that, then what kind of jihad are you doing? Okay, we understand that there are good days, as we mentioned, you know, of course, without doubt, the blessed wiladat of our ma'sumin, salamullahi alayhim, are going to be the best days, especially when it comes to something like a marriage, especially when it comes to something like a wedding celebration. These are beautiful days that you should use and seize that opportunity in doing something about it. If you don't have a certain kind of marriage or whatnot, then celebrate it. If you can't celebrate it in the masjid or in the Husseiniyah, celebrate it at home. Have some kind of, you know, regular program that you have, you know, that you, okay, well, you read Hadithul Kisa, you read the ziyarah of that ma'soom for that day, you turn on some candles, you give out some halawiyat, some sweets and food for your family members and your neighbors, you know, just so you, that whole environment, the atmosphere at home, it becomes a blessed atmosphere, an atmosphere where dhikru Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam is prioritized.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتی جنان است چه فرون دماغ و سواب داره فرون روزون است.
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرون درخت کاری اینجا کم سواب داره دعا هم داره سواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
Imam اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree.
محیط زیست نگه سالم نگه داره این دقل ثواب داره.
There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون. اینم هم امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Here Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli mentions that the significance of doing certain things on certain days in the week. It starts with Saturday, then Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. For example, Wednesday is kind of like a day where you really need to be careful in the sense that traveling, for example, is not that recommended. And Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says the last Wednesday of every Hijri month is a non-Mubarak day. As far as the validity of the ahadith and that are concerned, this is something that we need to look into. But seeing that Sheikh Jawadi Amuli mentions it, we are also mentioning it. Avoiding that kind of issue, for example, there are riwayat that say that a person should stay away from hijama, from cupping, on a Wednesday. There are other ahadith that say that, for example, I saw Imam Sadiq salamullahi alayhi doing hijama towards the end of Wednesday day. But again, the whole issue is that you are able to neutralize this through the paying of sadaqah. Then Thursday, then Friday, and we all know that the most important of days is Friday, as far as our religion is concerned, especially when it comes to personal hygiene, personal cleanliness, shaving, removal of hair, cutting your nails, which is why it is makruh to work and travel before Salatul Jumu'ah, that as the hadith says from Imam Sadiq Salamullah Alayhi, that you should make sure that Friday is your religious day, Friday is your study, your religious study day, Friday is your spiritual day. That's why there's so many ad'iyah and good things and mustahab things and prayers that a person can do on a Friday, especially Salat Ja'far al-Tayyar, which is something that I highly recommended my brothers and sisters to do. Uffin li rajul, Imam Sadiq says, woe upon a man, a Muslim man, lil rajul al Muslim, a Muslim man, and la yufarrig nafsahu, that who does not vacate himself fil isbu' yawm al jum'ah li amri dinihi fayas'al an. Woe be upon a Muslim man who does not vacate himself or empty his schedule for during the week on a Friday for matters of religion, where he is able to pursue his matters of religion. Last point in this episode is there's this Persian expression which basically means respecting and honoring time and having good time management. Vaqt shanas. Be a good time manager. Be someone who is able to schedule your day, plan your day, manage your day and your week and your month and your year effectively with balance as well. I think that's a very, very important point, that throughout each of the hours of the day, there's something productive that you are doing with balance. Little bit of spirituality, little bit of socializing, little bit of work, little bit of family time, little bit of personal entertainment, balancing your time. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Japan commemorates the 77th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Survivors and relatives mark the blast anniversary with a minute of silence. The United States dropped the first atomic bomb, codenamed Little Boy, on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, destroying the city and killing 140,000 people, mostly civilians and including many children. A second bomb 3 days later on Nagasaki killed another 70,000 and made Japan surrender and ended World War II. The bombs also left tens of thousands more dead in the months and years that followed, many from radiation-related illnesses. Many who survived the attacks continue to require welfare and medical care. During the memorial, the Japanese Prime Minister said the government would continue to support the survivors and demanded all nations to work together to promote the total abolition of nuclear weapons. It's still a goal far from being realized, but one held as strongly in the two cities that have suffered the most from such weapons. Meanwhile, the US, despite being the only country to have used weapons of mass destruction during war, seems to have learned no lesson from the horrific incident.
Their weapons should be eliminated from the entire earth. The United States, as a government, as a nation, has learned really no lessons. In fact, although there was a strong movement to eliminate nuclear weapons in the 1970s, resulting in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, in which the United States pledged to eliminate nuclear weapons, it did not do so, and in fact, over the last few years has committed, from the end of the Obama administration, to a $1 trillion nuclear weapons modernization program, which runs directly in the face of any commitment to eliminating nuclear weapons. And so it's really, the United States really has nothing to say about other countries having nuclear weapons until it gets its own act together.
In 1968, the world agreed on a new agreement, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Over 190 countries are currently signed up. Nuclear powers agreed to reduce their arsenals, in exchange others agreed not to have them at all. In the 70s, the deals between Russia and the US continued, more focused on long-range missiles, and though the rivalry between these two global powers intensified in 1991, there was a New START treaty aimed at decreasing the size of their arsenals and underpinning the West's justification for these weapons, which is an idea generally referred to as nuclear deterrence. But now Russia has intensified its rhetoric of using nuclear weapons in the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. The US and the EU, on the other hand, continue to provoke Moscow despite the threats.
Well, there really was no reason for this conflict with Russia other than the way in which it has aided the highly financialized speculative economy of the United States and, by extension, Germany, France, Great Britain, and Israel, which have committed to a system in which now, because of this massive printing of money and the creation of false assets, only a war economy can save them from this catastrophe. So provoking a war with Russia, a thoughtless and dangerous move, does have the effect of increasing the value of the dollar in the short term.
As tensions rise between these two countries, which still have the largest nuclear arsenals, the world is now forced to look at history and the present to avoid an incident similar to the tragedy of Hiroshima. During the 77th anniversary of the world's first atomic bomb attack, the United Nations Secretary General, while calling for disarmament, said the world is playing with a loaded gun.
And today, the world is in danger of forgetting the lessons forged years 77 years ago. Almost 13,000 nuclear weapons are being held. Stockpiles are being upgraded. And the common thread of potential nuclear annihilation runs through geopolitical crises the world over, from the Middle East to the Korean Peninsula to Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
A clear example of such threat would be Israel, which has persisted on possessing nuclear weapons. Iran has pushed for the establishment of a Middle East zone free of weapons of mass destruction, which the Islamic Republic initiated at the UN. But Israel won't comply. Tehran has even repeatedly warned that West Asia and the entire world is being threatened by nuclear weapons of the Israeli regime and urged international pressure on Tel Aviv to make it join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Gaza was flashed bright by explosions as Israeli artillery and other weapons targeted what they say were weapons factories and rocket launch sites belonging to the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Following the latest round of aggression initiated by the Israeli military, an aerial duel was also held as rockets were fired from Gaza towards Israel, some intercepted by the Israeli Iron Dome anti-missile system, yet many penetrated deep inside Israel, reaching as far as Tel Aviv. Earlier, in a televised address, the Israeli Prime Minister said the regime had zero tolerance for attacks from Gaza and that isn't interested in a wider conflict in Gaza but will not shy away from one either. Israel has labeled the latest round of aggression as a preemptive operation. It says it aimed to thwart alleged planned rocket attacks by the Islamic Jihad. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad called the initial Israeli bombardment a declaration of war, firing a barrage of at least 100 rockets into southern Israel. Around 13 people were taken to the hospital with minor injuries. Some reports have, however, indicated that many Israelis were killed in the retaliatory attacks. In response to the Israeli aggression, the Al-Quds brigades launched attacks on cities across the occupied territories. Hamas also announced its support for the Islamic Jihad and said it would respond to the strikes. Israel claims it targets military sites, but similar to all other attacks by the regime, civilians seem to be on the receiving end of the rockets.
Definitely, this is a war crime. It's a war crime in itself. The bombing in itself is a war crime. The siege of Gaza and the blockade for 15 years is a war crime. The starving people, cutting off the electricity and cutting off the water supply and cutting off the ability for Palestinians to import much necessary food and building supplies and medicine and allow people to leave and come back is a war crime in itself. This is not acceptable. And that's one thing. The second aspect of it is that the fact that Israel has claimed and actually publicly announced that it is using this as a preemptive in itself is also a war crime, because even in international law of war, you are supposed to respond in a proportionate manner if you are being attacked. Actually, even this time, Israel itself admitted that there has been no provocation. Israel has been provoking again and again and again and has been provoking the Palestinians in order to create a war with the Palestinians and in order to punish Palestinians again and again. So Palestinians have not done anything yet. And so Israel went and bombed and killed so many children, so many civilians, has destroyed again Gaza. This is apartheid. This is a crime against humanity.
The United States has time and again vowed to support Israel. This includes the US President's latest trip to Israel, where he pledged full military support for Israel with regard to the Iron Dome, a new laser system, and other military support. And now regarding the latest round of attack against Gaza, the US ambassador to the regime said Israel has a right to defend itself. That is a green light for Israel to continue with its rocket attacks. The UK Foreign Secretary also echoed similar remarks, adding that the kingdom stands by Israel.
Biden has continued support for Israel unconditionally. He repeated support for Israel and quote-unquote its security when it is not even threatened. It's the one that's threatening the security of the Palestinian people, including the children, women, elderly people, disabled, everybody. Israel is threatening the security. It's not the other way around. So for the United States to go around and for Joe Biden making so many promises during his campaign against Bush, against Trump, that he was going to roll back many of the aggressive actions of Trump, which were already before Trump, not really happily during Obama as well, and Joe Biden was his vice president. They were actually very problematic against the Palestinians. For Biden not to even reverse the aggressive steps that Trump has taken against the Palestinians, but to continue military aid, economic aid, collaboration with Israel, justification for Israel's attack on, it is giving a green light, and it is exactly the way we all understood it.
Those statements have, however, drawn criticism from the United Nations. The UN Special Reporter on the Occupied Palestinian Territories slammed the US for the remarks and stated that Israel cannot claim that it is defending itself in this conflict. She also condemned the regime's attacks as illegal and irresponsible. Meanwhile, the office of the Palestinian president called this week's attack a dangerous escalation. The regime's attacks was also followed by a closure of two border crossings with the Gaza Strip. But Palestine has witnessed such acts of aggression from time and again, and the heaviest price is always paid by the civilians. The Gaza Strip has been under an Israeli blockade since 2007. That is 15 years of a blockade. Israel has also waged many wars against the Gaza Strip and killed scores of Palestinians, yet there's no mention of this, while Russia's war in Ukraine takes center stage on a daily basis.
A series of drills across six zones surrounding Chinese Taipei. Conventional missile firepower assault in the waters east of Taiwan. More than 100 warplanes, including fighters and bombers, as well as over 10 destroyers and frigates. These are the largest military drills that China has conducted perhaps ever, showing its awesome military might. This level of force displayed in such a manner shows how angry China is at the U.S. and the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit.
Since 1949,
that Taiwan is an integral part of China. And they see that as China has moved from being under the control of imperialist powers to becoming a strong, independent nation, that they intend to exercise sovereignty over all of their historical, geographical range, including Taiwan.
Ironically, the G7 group of countries and the High Representative of the European Union have now issued a statement condemning these exercises, claiming that they threaten the stability of the region. In this instance, the European side has now backed the U.S. when it comes to its stance against China. Is this another Ukraine conflict scenario playing out? China sees this as a provocation, since it is endorsing and encouraging pro-separatist and pro-independence forces on the island.
Chinese made their strikes, probably using our visit as an excuse. Let me close by saying this. The Chinese have tried to isolate Taiwan. They may try to keep Taiwan from visiting or participating in other places, but they will not isolate Taiwan by preventing us to travel there.
China has in the past viewed Chinese Taipei as part of its territory. It has also publicly stated that it may take it by force one day if necessary. This is where the U.S. and now Europe come in. Just like Ukraine, both are warning China against any thoughts of a takeover, which parallels the conflict in Ukraine.
The People's Liberation Army has now declared 7 restricted zones near Taiwan and say that they will extend a range of military exercises through Monday. These provocative actions are a significant escalation.
I think the issue of provoking China is this. The United States does not have, as part of its sort of thinking, that somebody is going to be our equal. Now, we have in the Western Pacific this amazing amount of military. Well, China happens to be there. You know, that's part of the world that they're in. And I think that as time goes on, and they have been very clear about this, that they're not prepared to cede American military hegemony to us in the Western Pacific much longer.
But China is not Ukraine, if the military display of China is anything to go by. The U.S. provocations against China and Europe's support come at a dangerous time when the world economy is on the precipice. The U.S. anti-China stance and China's maneuvers are taking place along some of the world's busiest shipping routes. Let's not forget, the global supply of vital semiconductors and electronic equipment produced in East Asia are in this region. Additionally, more than 60% of global maritime trade and more than 22% of the total global trade passes through the South China Sea. Is the U.S. and its European allies willing to risk this?
The war in Ukraine has created massive political and geostrategic shifts in alliances at regional and international levels. The war has now brought back the specter of the Cold War to the global scene. Russia, which is at loggerheads with the United States and its Western allies, says the era of constructive cooperation between Russia and Western countries is irrevocably over. Moscow says the end of the partnership is regardless of the result of the war in Ukraine. Regardless of the duration and outcome of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, we can already state now that the 30-year era of generally constructive, though not problematic, cooperation with the West is irrevocably over.
Well, in politics, nothing is definite and irreversible, as we well know. Certainly, the situation is deeply affected by the events and the stanch positions of either side, particularly the Western and the Russian side. So in the near future, which means in the forthcoming months, is not envisageable a reversal of the distancing that has been signaled by both Russia and the United States and Europe on the issue of Ukraine.
The Russian official added that the current crisis has provided a unique opportunity to get rid of, quote, residual illusions. He also added that Moscow will use the crisis to go beyond the paradigm of what he described as friendly absorption, which Moscow says has been produced over and over again since 1992. It refers to a climate in which dominant powers following the collapse of the Soviet Union promised Russia to accept it as a member of advanced Western developed nations. It's now a fact that the West and its allies are no longer the hegemon powers at the international stage. Following the war in Ukraine, the West imposed a raft of massive and unprecedented sanctions on Russia in a bid to weaken Moscow or to potentially make its economy collapse. The sanctions have hurt Russia's economy, but did not trigger its collapse. On the contrary, Russia's oil and gas revenues have soared over the past few months.
The Western side, with its approach, is also imposing a set of rules which are based on its own interests, although they pretend these rules to be universal. The rest of the world is instead proposing to identify shared rules which may differ in the practice according to the latitude and the cultural experience of the different societies. So this is the existential clash between the two sides.
It's now Western citizens who are paying higher gas and energy prices. The crisis has indeed negatively affected European and North American nations and their economies. It's now widely believed that the U.S. has failed to create a united global front against Russia. The asymmetry of interests and perspectives between Washington and Moscow is unlikely to change anytime soon.
On this, we have to add the fact that the manufacturing capacity of the world has moved from the West to the East, particularly to the Far East, which is Asia. And this weakens considerably the perspectives of the West in long-term confrontation with the rest of the world.
And the latest spat between the United States and China over Taiwan is likely to further strain the relations between the Western-led bloc and the emerging counter-hegemonic alliance. Under these circumstances, emerging powers like Iran, with its vast energy sources and rising military might, can play a pivotal role in the shifting balances between the East and the West.
The Limelight.
The extradition, trial, and conviction of Julian Assange would have frightening ramifications for investigative journalism, says Marjorie Kahn, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Julian Assange is enduring unbearable persecution for exposing U.S. war crimes. Stay tuned for more. Ever since UK Home Secretary Priti Patel formally ordered the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the US last week, press freedom advocates around the world have been mobilizing. Assange Defense is organizing a national and international campaign to pressure US Attorney General Merrick Garland and Joe Biden to drop the extradition request and dismiss the charges against Assange. The stakes could not be higher. The charges against Assange, including 17 under the infamous Espionage Act, could result in 175 years in prison for the journalist who exposed U.S. war crimes. Last week, Assange's brother, filmmaker Gabriel Shipton, wrote in an email to Truthout, UK Home Secretary has decided today that any publisher who exposes national security information of an allied country may face extradition to 2 lifetimes in prison. Julian will appeal this decision, and this once-in-a-lifetime fight for freedom of the press continues. Assange's indictment is based on WikiLeaks' 2010 to 2011 disclosures of U.S. war crimes in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the military prison at Guantanamo. Those revelations included 400,000 field reports about the Iraq War, 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians, and systematic rape, torture, and murder committed by U.S. forces, handed over detainees to a notorious Iraqi torture squad. WikiLeaks also disclosed the war logs, which are 90,000 reports or more civilian casualties by coalition forces than the U.S. military had admitted to in Afghanistan. And its revelations additionally included the Guantanamo files, 779 secret reports showing that 150 innocent people had been held there for years, and documenting the torture and abuse of 800 men and boys in violation of the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment. WikiLeaks also published the notorious Collateral Murder video, which documented how in 2007, a U.S. Army Apache helicopter gunship targeted and fired on unarmed civilians in Baghdad. At least 18 civilians were killed. They included two Reuters reporters and a man who came to rescue the wounded. Two children were injured. Then a U.S. Army tank drove over one of the bodies, severing it in half. That video contains evidence of three separate war crimes that are prohibited by the Geneva Conventions and the U.S. Army Field Manual. As several civil liberties and human rights organizations declared in October 2021, when they asked Garland to dismiss the case against Assange, his prosecution poses a significant threat to First Amendment freedom of the press. The UK's decision to extradite Julian Assange to the nation that plotted to assassinate him, the nation that wants to imprison him for 175 years for publishing truthful information in the public interest, is an abomination, wrote Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg, and Alice Walker, co-chairs of Assange Defense, in reaction to Patel's extradition order. The U.S. government argues that its venerated constitution does not protect journalism the government dislikes and that publishing truthful information in the public interest is a subversive criminal act. This argument is a threat not only to journalism but to democracy itself. Trevor Tim, Executive Director of Freedom of the Press Foundation, warned that if Assange is extradited to the United States and convicted of the charges against him, it would potentially make receiving classified information, asking for sources for more information, and publishing certain types of classified information a crime. Tim noted, journalists, of course, engage in all these activities regularly. Moreover, Assange has suffered psychological torture while confined in the UK for more than a decade, according to Nils Meltzer, United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture. In December 2021, Meltzer tweeted that the UK is literally torturing him to death. On June 10th, more than 300 doctors, psychiatrists, and psychologists calling themselves Doctors for Assange wrote to Patel that Assange's deteriorating health made it medically and ethically unacceptable to extradite him. Julian's 13-year persecution culminates in a decision of ostentatious, callous indifference, John Shipton, Assange's father, told Truthout, adding, "Who amongst us would not bend with indignation and loathing?" Stella Assange, who recently married Julian in prison, called Patel's decision a dark day for press freedom and for British democracy. She told the Associated Press, "Julian did nothing wrong. He has committed no crime and is not a criminal. He is a journalist and a publisher, and he is being punished for doing his job." Yet UK officials disregarded Assange's health and the injustice of his prosecution, insisting that the US would treat him appropriately. In its June 17th statement ordering Assange's extradition, the UK Home Office wrote, "In this case, the UK courts have not found that it would be oppressive, unjust, or an abuse of process to extradite Ms. Assange, nor have they found that extradition would be incompatible with his human rights, including his right to a fair trial and to the freedom of expression, and that whilst in the US, he will be treated appropriately, including in relation to his health." But after a three-week evidentiary hearing, UK District Judge Vanessa Baritzer ruled in January 2021 that if Assange were extradited to the United States, he would likely attempt suicide because of his mental state and the onerous conditions of confinement in US prisons. The United States later came forward with qualified assurances that Assange wouldn't be kept in solitary confinement, and the UK